programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread in Logan, open for breakfast Monday through Friday at 7 a.m. and Saturdays at 8 a.m., offering a selection of French pastries and a variety of sweet and savory menu items. Details at crumbbrothers.com.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Eboo Patel founded the Interfaith Youth Corps to counter the growing problem of religious intolerance and violence at home and abroad. Interfaith Youth Corps trains students to bridge the faith divide through interfaith cooperation. And Eboo Patel says that interfaith interactions can be a bomb of destruction, a barrier of division, a bubble of isolation, or a bridge of cooperation. And he says he's inspired to build a bridge of cooperation by his faith as a Muslim, his Indian heritage, and his American citizenship. He was named by U.S. News & World Report as one of America's best leaders of 2009. He's author of three books about interfaith cooperation, including Acts of Faith and Sacred Ground. And he serves on the Council on Foreign Relations and the Department of Homeland Security's Faith-Based Advisory Council. He holds a doctorate in the sociology of religion from Oxford University, where he studied as a Rhodes Scholar. He's coming to Utah for several events at Utah State University. The convocation address, to which everyone is invited, it's free and open to the public, is entitled Building Bridges of Interfaith Cooperation. That is next week. It's in the Kent Concert Hall on the USU campus, 7 p.m., Thursday, September 4th. There'll be a book signing immediately after the event. Books will be available at the venue and at the USU bookstore as well. And the convocation is a kicking off event for a Better Together campaign at USU. It's being organized by members of a newly organized USU Interfaith Initiative. And the next event is a student-led interfaith speed faithing panel, which will be held at the Taggart Student Center on Wednesday, September 17th. By the way, anybody interested in participating with the USU Interfaith Initiative can email the group interfaith@usu.edu. They're also on Facebook and Twitter as USU Interfaith Initiative. So with that long introduction, Eboo Patel, welcome to the program.
Terrific to be with you. Thank you so much for having me.
Appreciate you being with us, and thanks for coming out to Utah. I'll look forward to the events out here. I'd like to start with some of your biography, answer the question how you got involved in this work and this passion of yours. So I understand you grew up in Illinois?
That's right. I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. I live in the city of Chicago right now. And growing up in high school, I had friends from a range of different religious identities and backgrounds. I had a friend who was a Cuban Jew, a Nigerian evangelical friend, a South Indian Hindu friend, a Catholic friend, and an LDS friend who was probably my closest friend in my latter years in high school. And actually, we dated for a year. So I grew up amidst religious diversity, but we never talked about religion, which is something that I found could actually be a bad thing, because oftentimes when there's a vacuum about a topic, it's nefarious forces or negative forces that fill that vacuum. So there was a period of time in my high school years when kind of the thugs in my school started going after my Jewish friend, saying anti-Semitic things in the hallways and scrawling anti-Semitic things on desks. And I realized that the people who were willing to talk about religion were the people who were open anti-Semites. And those of us who thought that religion was a bridge of cooperation or that religion could be something that we engaged positively, our silence had created a vacuum for negative forces to fill.
And it was years later, I think, you found out, you talked to this friend, this Jewish friend, about how he felt during that period.
That's right. And you know, I remember it was one of the summers during our college years. We were back together in the suburbs of Chicago, and he shared with me that those were the worst months of his life, and that the hardest part of it wasn't the terrible things that those thugs in my high school were saying. It was the silence of his friends. And I remember feeling just humiliated, shamed by that. I still think it's the most humiliating moment of my life as I look back. And I remember having a conversation with my dad not long after, and my dad was deeply disappointed in me. And he said, Eboo, you failed your friend, but you also failed your faith. And that was a striking statement to me. And it actually was one of the reasons for me delving deeper into my own religion of Islam and learning about the Muslim inspiration to stand up for other people, including, and in some cases especially, people from other traditions.
And you describe, I think this is in Acts of Faith, you describe sitting around lunchroom table with all these friends, very diverse group. But as you said before, you never really talked about your faith, never totally talked about religion. I mean, things would come up, things I can't eat right now or things I'm doing because, you know, because of my religion. But it's sort of an elephant in the room.
That's right. And actually, we pretended that the elephant wasn't in the room. It didn't seem like an issue until other people negatively made it an issue. And this is one of the key reasons that I started getting into interfaith cooperation and started Interfaith Youth Corps. Number one, because we unfortunately have a lot of negative forces out there in the country and the world, forces that seek to create religious division, that seek to advance religious prejudice, and in some cases that are outright physically destructive in the form of violence. That tends to happen more in other parts of the world, but in a globalized world, we're certainly subject to those forces. But there's a more positive side of it also. I think to myself, I could have learned so much from my friends from other religions. There's in my own Muslim community, volunteerism is a major ethic, and you know, we would be involved in projects with homeless shelters and in disaster relief and in environmental cleanups. And as I learned more about my friends' religions, I realized that service was an important ethic across those religions. And I think to myself, you know, what if we had cooperated together? How much more could we have done for people who were destitute in the western suburbs of Chicago? How much more could we have done regarding environmental cleanups had we cooperated? So in my view, interfaith cooperation is mostly about accentuating the positive, accentuating the learning we can have from each other, deepening into our own religions, cooperating to serve others, but it's also about neutralizing the negative, if you will, making sure that the forces of prejudice, the forces of division and violence do not win the day when it comes to religiously diverse societies.
You talk a lot about religious pluralism and the importance of that, embracing that. That's the real divide. We'll get into that as we go along. I'd like to talk about your college days. Before we get there, there's an interesting passage in Acts of Faith. It sounds like you had a great relationship with your grandmother. I don't know if she's still alive.
You know, she is. She's in her mid-90s. She's still going. She's still doing the great work that she's doing. And you're right that being with her during this summer, not long after I graduated from college, was a turning point in my life. The story is that I woke up in her apartment in the southern part of the city of Bombay in India one day. I was staying with her over the summer, and there was a woman in her little apartment who was new. She was a young woman in her 20s, and she didn't look like she was part of the extended family or she was part of the household help. And I said to my grandmother, I said, "No, Mama, who is this woman?" And my grandmother says, I don't know her real name. The leader of the local Muslim community brought her here because she's having a difficult time at home. She's being abused by her uncle and her father. So I told the leader of the Muslim community that I would take care of her for a while. Let's call her Anissa while she's here, and we'll get her to a different place to get her to safety soon. And I kind of gave my grandmother a mild scolding. I said, Mama, you can't just take in refugee women from the streets into your home. You know, you're getting up there in age, and this is dangerous, not just for you, but for all of us. And my grandmother gave me this arched eyebrows look, and she said, how old are you? And I said, 22. And she said, I've been doing this work for twice the number of years that you've been alive. And she went to a cupboard, and she brought out this shoebox, and inside the shoebox was all of these Polaroid pictures, dozens and dozens of pictures of these young women that she had taken into her home over the past half century and effectively kept safe, nursed back to health, helped them get jobs, helped them continue their education. She pointed at one, she said, her teeth were bad, and I helped her get her teeth fixed. I found a dentist who would do it for low cost. And after, my grandmother tells me 7 or 8 of these stories, I said, why do you do this? And my grandmother looked at me as if, isn't the reason obvious? And she just kind of shrugged her shoulders. She said, I'm a Muslim. This is what we Muslims do. And similar to that moment with my dad about failing my Jewish friend when my dad said, you failed your faith. This was a turning point in my relationship with Islam because I saw with my own eyes the kind of work that Islam inspired my grandmother to do. And I had deep respect for it. And I started to ask myself, you know, if I'm going to call myself a Muslim, one who submits to the will of God, if I'm going to claim Islam as my own religion, what am I doing to make myself worthy of that tradition?
And so then you, of course, sir, you investigated your own faith, became more, I guess, converted to your own faith, but you looked outside as well. You looked at other faiths.
Well, you know, this my path really between, I would say, the ages of 17 and 22 or 23 was, I think, learning about a range of faiths. And then ultimately that moment with my grandmother was kind of sealed my own commitment and deepening into Islam. And having learned about that range of other traditions, the LDS tradition, Buddhism, Judaism, Catholicism, Protestant Christianity, I had deep admiration for all of those. And I was seeing the commonalities across them, especially when it comes to serving others. But ultimately, I think people have to have a home, at least I do. And my home was and is in Islam. Hmm.
There's an interesting quote, and I believe this is in maybe Acts of Faith. I'll just read this. It's about a paragraph. Have you respond to it. You say, I'm an American Muslim from India. My adolescence was a series of rejections, one after another, of the various dimensions of my heritage, in the belief that America, India, and Islam could not coexist within the same being. If I wanted to be one, I could not be the others. My struggle to understand the traditions I belong to as mutually enriching rather than mutually exclusive is the story of a generation of young people standing at the crossroads of inheritance and discovery, trying to look both ways at once. And I think what you're getting at there is you're representative of many young people.
Well, you know, honestly, I wrote the book 8 or 10 years ago, and I'm not sure that I would make such a grandiose claim now. I do think that many people, young at heart, if you will, they feel themselves connected to multiple stories, multiple traditions. They have an intersection of identities, and figuring out how that intersectionality is going to exist within a single being, I think is a beautiful challenge and struggle, and I think that one that young people feel particularly sharply. So, you know, figuring out how I was going to understand being Indian and Muslim and American in social circles in which one identity might have been deeply accepted and others looked at dismissively. And then, of course, I'd go to a different circle and say everybody wanted to ignore me being Muslim, but they embraced me being American. I had to figure out who I was given those variety of internal identities and that range of circles that I'm in. And I would say that is now the standard story for the vast majority of American young people. That at some that they are many things. They're not just American. They're not just LDS. They're not just Samoan. They are all of those things. They're American and Samoan and LDS, and that they're going to exist in a range of different circles that has a variety of ways of looking at those different identities. And that negotiation, I think, is a very challenging negotiation. And it's one of the things that we focus on at IFYC.
We're talking with Eboo Patel. He is founder and president of Interfaith Youth Corps. He founded this to counter the growing problem of religious intolerance and violence at home and abroad. IFYC trains students to bridge the faith divide using interfaith cooperation. And Eboo Patel is coming to Utah. There are several events at Utah State University. He'll give a convocation address next week. It's entitled Building Bridges of Interfaith Cooperation. It's in the Kent Concert Hall on the USU campus, 7 p.m. on Thursday, September 4th. This event is free and open to the public. There'll be a book signing of his latest book, Sacred Ground, immediately after. Books are available at the USU bookstore and will be for sale at the convocations as well. And the convocation is a kicking off event for the USU Better Together campaign. That's being organized by members of the USU Interfaith Initiative. This is new to USU. Their next event is a student-led interfaith speed faithing panel, which will be held in the Taggart Student Center Auditorium from beginning at 7 o'clock on Wednesday, September 17th. Anyone interested in participating in this or other events or participating in the USU Interfaith Initiative can email the group at interfaith@usu.edu. They're also on Facebook and Twitter as USU Interfaith Initiative. And there's a roundtable Eboo Patel is leading on Friday, September 5th of next week, 8 to 10 a.m. It's entitled Catalyzing Interfaith Leadership Best Practices. There are just a few spots remaining for this by-invitation-only event. And those people interested in committing at least an hour a week to being part of the initiative can contact interfaith@usu.edu. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about this statement from Eboo Patel. He says, religious extremism is a movement of the young taking action, and therefore needs to be counteracted with young people on the other side embracing religious pluralism. We'll talk about that and much more with Eboo Patel following the break.
This is Steve Tracy, bringing more to life. For the first time, adult couples have more parents than children. How do you prepare for this new role? Communication is key to success in any job. The role of caretaker is no exception. Begin with your parents' wishes. Talk to them about personal goals, housing, legal, financial, and medical decisions. Some of these conversations may be easy. Some will be difficult. Start the conversation now to bring more to their lives.
Support for Bringing More to Life on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our listeners and the Sunshine Terrace Foundation in Logan, advancing wellness, independence, dignity, and comfort. Information at sunshineterrace.com.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. My guest today is Eboo Patel. He joins us from Chicago. That's where the Interfaith Youth Corps is based. This is an organization founded by Eboo Patel to counter the problem of religious intolerance and violence. The organization trains students to bridge the faith divide through interfaith cooperation. Eboo Patel was named by U.S. News and World Report as one of America's best leaders of 2009. He's author of several books, including Acts of Faith, The Story of an American Muslim in the Struggle for the Soul of a Generation. The latest book is Sacred Ground, Pluralism, Prejudice, and the Promise of America. Eboo Patel is coming to Utah. There are several events, including a convocation address. That's on Thursday, September 4th. It's next week in the Kent Concert Hall on the USU campus, 7 p.m. That's free and open to the public. There'll be a book signing of Sacred Ground following. Books will be available at the venue. At a convocation is a kicking off event for the USU Better Together campaign. It's organized by members of the USU Interfaith Initiative. And if you're interested in joining that initiative, you can email them at interfaith@usu.edu. They're also on Facebook and Twitter as USU Interfaith Initiative. Eboo Patel, some of your writings, you made a very stark contrast. This was very effective in my mind, in any case, as you introduce the idea of religious pluralism and the extreme need for that. You compared and contrasted a couple of young people, or several young people, Eric Rudolph, on the one hand, and middle schoolers, and I believe it's in West Virginia, on the other hand. I wonder if you'd take us through that. Eric Rudolph, of course, was the bomber at the Olympics in Atlanta. He also bombed a women's clinic. Was raised in an extreme Christian tradition, white supremacist, and that's as compared and contrasted to these middle schoolers who embraced the history of the Holocaust.
Right. So this is a story that I tell at the beginning of my first book, Acts of Faith. And it's meant to introduce an important theme that we focus on here at Interfaith Youth Corps, which is that young people are frequently both the foot soldiers of religious extremism, and you can read about this in the newspaper any day of the week, unfortunately, especially news around the world, that the people who are unfortunately killing other people to the soundtrack of prayer are generally in their teens and 20s. And that's a deep sadness, I think, that energy has been twisted and channeled in a horribly destructive way. On the other hand, so many of the people that we collectively admire most were young when they began their movements, including their interfaith movements. And so Mahatma Gandhi, the great Hindu leader from India, was in his early 20s when he began his movement against the racist pass laws in South Africa in the early 20th century. Martin Luther King Jr. was only 26 years old when he led the Montgomery bus boycott. And that's the reason that we focus on young people and college campuses at Interfaith Youth Corps, because we believe that young people can be the people who make religion a bridge of cooperation, just as they have over history. But we're well aware that other people are seeking to twist young people in the exact opposite direction and have those young people make religion a bomb of destruction. It's one of the reasons that folks like Allison Fife, right there at the USU campus, a senior at USU and a leader in the Better Together movement there, inspire me so much. She came to our Interfaith Leadership Institute here in Chicago, where she met 150 other students like her from across the country who were going back to their campuses to lead movements that bring young people who orient around religion differently together to focus on serving others and learning from one another. And it's people like Professor Glass Coffin, a professor there at USU who's been our key link to the campus and to the movement there, who inspire students like Allison to do their work. So we think college campuses are an ideal place to do this work, precisely because there are students like Allison and professors like Bonnie Glass Coffin on those campuses.
What's the ideal then? What are we striving for? Is it religious pluralism? It's learning about other faiths, associating, service?
Great question. So we call the ideal that we're striving for pluralism, but we have a very particular definition of it, and I'll tell you what that means. We think pluralism has three parts: respect for identity, positive relationships between people from different backgrounds and different identities, and a commitment to the common good. So just to be very clear, we do not believe pluralism means believing in every religion or accepting as true other people's religions. We're very clear here on our staff at Interfaith Youth Corps that folks who are Buddhist and folks who are Hindu are very different. People who are Christian and people who are Muslim believe in very different things. People with commitments to the LDS tradition and people with commitments to the Jain tradition, those are different traditions. So respect for identity is not acceptance of every truth or other people's truths. It's simply a recognition that other people have a right to their religion. They have a right to interpret it as they see fit, and they have a right to express that interpretation in the form of preaching, in the form of building organizations, et cetera, et cetera. And we ought to have a sense of respect for that. So although I am not LDS, I have deep admiration and respect for the LDS tradition, in large part because I have met so many wonderful LDS people. That's what we mean by respect for identity. Not acceptance of other truths, not believing in all religions, simply the recognition that other people have a right to their interpretation of their religion, a right to express that, and that I ought to have some appreciation of dimensions of that tradition that I admire. The second part is relationships, so that we should have positive relationships with each other. We should have positive relationships based on the things that we have in common, for example, like service. And we should be able to have positive and civil conversations about things that are different. And when you're dealing with different religions, there are, of course, both commonalities and differences. We can come together on the commonalities. We can talk politely and civilly about the differences. And then finally, we ought to actually do things together, do things that benefit the rest of the country and the world together. And I think the LDS community is a model of this. The LDS community's efforts in service are so important to American civil society and indeed global civil society. And I'd love to see more religious communities cooperating together in service projects like disaster relief or Habitat for Humanity builds or environmental cleanups, etc. And those are the kinds of things that serve the common good.
What are the barriers? I could think of one, which would be, and Professor Glass-Coffner at USU cites a Pew Research Center survey about religious literacy, so that in that survey, less than half of the questions about major world religions were answered correctly. Is that a barrier and a starting point, just learning about each other?
Sure. I think that the lack of what we call appreciative knowledge about other religions is an important barrier to building religious pluralism. But honestly, I think the single biggest barrier is simply not making this a high enough priority. And I think that in the 21st century, it ought to be one of the highest priorities in our country and in the world. Societies around the world, and certainly the United States, are getting increasingly religiously diverse. They're also getting increasingly mobile, which means that it's simply standard operating procedure that either you or your kids or your grandkids are going to be frequently interacting with people who have different religious identities. Making sure that that interaction is positive, is constructive, builds pluralism rather than creates discord, I think is important for social cohesion. But it's also a sacred value. One of the things that I learned from my close Mormon friend in high school was the LDS tradition puts an emphasis on positive relations with others. It's almost considered holy, and that's also the case in Islam. And so we think that, in a way, the greatest barrier to the absence of religious pluralism is not enough people saying, this is a really high priority, and I'm going to commit to this. And again, that's one of the reasons I'm so excited to come out to Utah State University, because people like Bonnie and Allison have advanced this on this campus, and then the administrative leaders of that campus, President Albrecht and others, have decided we're going to make this a priority. And I think that that's really inspiring.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Eboo Patel. He is the founder and president of Interfaith Youth Corps, which trains students to bridge the faith divide through interfaith cooperation. He says interfaith interactions can be a bomb of destruction, a barrier of division, a bubble of isolation, or a bridge of cooperation. He says he's inspired to build a bridge of cooperation by his faith as a Muslim, his Indian heritage, and his American citizenship. Eboo Patel is coming to Utah for several events at Utah State University. There's a convocation address, free and open to the public. That is next week. It's Thursday, September 4th in the Kent Concert Hall on the OSU campus, 7 p.m. And there'll be a book signing of his latest book, Sacred Ground. That'll be available for sale at the venue, and it's for sale right now at the OSU bookstore. And this convocation is a kicking off event for the OSU Better Together campaign that's being organized by the newly organized OSU Interfaith Initiative. And they have several events. Anyone interested in participating in this initiative can contact them at interfaith@usu.edu. They're also on Facebook and Twitter as USU Interfaith Initiative. And they have a roundtable. Eboo Patel will be at a roundtable Friday, September 5th in the morning, 8 to 10 a.m., Catalyzing Interfaith Leadership Best Practices. There are a few spots remaining for this. It's by invitation only for people interested in committing at least an hour a week to being part of the initiative, and they can contact USU Interfaith Initiative at interfaith@usu.edu to see if there are still spots available. Eboo Patel, you have pointed out early in the program and in your writings that reaching out to youth is certainly a priority for those who are religiously intolerant, terrorists and the like. Behind every young person who's a suicide bomber, there's somebody there who's a mentor. And so that needs to be counteracted. As you go around to campuses and the like, are you hopeful? Are young people receptive to these ideas?
Well, I'm I'm hopeful in part because I'm an optimist by disposition, and also because the work that I do does bring me into contact with a lot of the Allison Fifes of the world and the Bonnie Glass Coffins of the world, which is to say people who are making interfaith cooperation a high priority, are either inspired young people making this one of their missions in the world, or inspired professors inspiring young people. So I feel good about the, you know, as Martin Luther King called it, the arc of justice is the arc of the universe is long but bends towards justice. So I think that will be the case when it comes to religious pluralism. I have to say that I think the LDS community is a model in terms of the responsibility that it gives young people. I mean, to make young people the folks who are most responsible for spreading your tradition in the form of missionaries is a huge responsibility. Having known several LDS folks who've done missions and have told me about how it was a significant maturation period of their lives, it made them who they are today. I just have great admiration for that.
I wonder, as I think about it, you talk about the LDS community, of course, the majority religion and faith in Utah and in some areas of the West, Western United States, is there a different or a heavier responsibility on the biggest faith community in any given area? And I'm thinking about, you know, in many areas of the world, LDS faith is minority, sometimes very small minority. In Utah, it's the majority faith.
You know, Tom, I think that's a terrific question. Thank you for asking that. I mean, I guess I do think that there is a special responsibility on that corresponds to people who are the majority. I think to myself that the vast majority of LDS folks I have known have been in the minority because I live in Chicago and, you know, I went to the University of Illinois, and then I went to graduate school in England. And one of the things that they have reported to me as being important is people around them who were in the majority, whether it was Christians or secular folks in the case of much of Europe, having an understanding of their tradition and seeking to proactively accommodate it, right? Recognizing the importance of the ward in LDS life, recognizing that LDS interaction across genders is different than the interaction of much of secular society, not looking dismissively at it, but looking appreciatively at it, seeking to learn from it. And I think that because so many folks who are part of the LDS tradition have received that hospitality by others and frankly have received the opposite, which is they've received hostility, that in the place in which the LDS community is the majority, to think to themselves, how would we like to be treated where we are the minority, and therefore how might we want to treat the minority religious communities here? Jews, Muslims, Catholics, really anybody else in Utah, right? I think that that's not only a positive civic value, but I think it's a my own sense is it's a theological value as well.
Before we go to another break, I'd like to bring up a very thorny issue, maybe taking some of these principles into and applying them possibly to what seems like a very intractable problem. That's the Israeli-Palestinian divide. And things just seem to be getting worse and worse. And I'm thinking specifically about the famous open letter written by Syed Kashua, who's an Arab-Palestinian living in Israel. His language is Hebrew. He was committed to, you know, trying to bridge that divide. And this is all mixed up. It's faith, it's politics, and it's long-standing, you know, revenge cycle as well. But he famously said he can no longer live in Israel, and he's coming to the U.S. Some of these principles trying to bridge that divide. What would you say applying that to this very intractable problem?
I mean, it is a massive problem. My guess is just based on anecdotal evidence that more people in the last 6 weeks have defriended each other over Facebook than at any other time in the history of Facebook, because they're at each other's throats, if you will, over different views of this challenge. So, listen, that actually highlights, I think, one of the opportunities we have in the United States, which is if the worst thing that you can do is defriend somebody over Facebook, that's a whole lot better than getting a bomb dropped on you or dropping a bomb on somebody else, which is to say, we live in a country that, for the most part, doesn't have violent religious conflict. Therefore, the way we talk to each other, the language we use, the quality of our discourse, I think is hugely important. In other words, let's make sure that the violent tensions in the Middle East or anywhere else in the world, frankly, let's make sure they're not translated to American shores. And let's actually see if the way that we can engage one another here, Hindus and Buddhists, who have a big problem in Sri Lanka with each other right now, Muslims and Jews, significant challenge in the Middle East, Catholics and Pentecostals in Brazil, right? There's various groups in various forms of tension all over the world. I think part of the ideal of America is that communities connected to those groups here are able to build positive relationships instead of being poisoned by the negative relationships. And those positive relationships can have some ameliorative, radiating quality.
We'll take another break when we come back. More with Eboo Patel. He's founder and president of Interfaith Youth Corps, which trains students to bridge the faith divide through interfaith cooperation. And he's coming to Utah for several events at Utah State University. There's a convocation address Thursday, September 4th, 7 p.m. at the Kent Concert Hall. This event is free and open to the public. The title is Building Bridges of Interfaith Cooperation. There'll be a book signing of his latest book, Sacred Ground, immediately after. Books are available at the USU bookstore and also for sale at the venue there. And this convocation is a kicking off event for the USU Better Together campaign. That's being organized by the new USU Interfaith Initiative. Their next event, by the way, sounds interesting. It's a student-led interfaith speed faithing panel, which will be held in the Taggart Student Center Auditorium at 7 o'clock on Wednesday, September 17th. Anyone interested in participating in this or other events or just getting involved with USU Interfaith Initiative can email the group. Their email is interfaith@usu.edu. They're also on Facebook and Twitter. Look for USU Interfaith Initiative. And if you're interested in getting really involved, there's a roundtable that Eboo Patel is leading. That's on Friday, September 5th from 8 to 10 a.m., titled Catalyzing Interfaith Leadership Best Practices. There are a few spots remaining to this event. It's by invitation only. And if you're interested in committing at least an hour a week to being part of the initiative, Interfaith Initiative at USU, you can contact interfaith@usu.edu. When we come back, I'm going to ask Eboo Patel to respond to the following. Some people just throw up their hands and say that the answer to faith-based intolerance and violence is to walk away from faith. They say that faith and religion itself is the problem. We'll talk about that and other things following the break.
This is folk singer Michael Jonathan. She's a true American music legend, and she's celebrating the music of Ireland on her new release. It's Judy Collins for the whole hour. Oh, no. She has a special guest with her, songwriter Ari Hess. It's both artists, music, and conversation on the next broadcast of the Wood Songs, Old Time Radio.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest today, we're very pleased to have Eboo Patel. He's founder and president of Interfaith Youth Corps. That's an organization based in Chicago. It trains students to bridge the faith divide through interfaith cooperation. Eboo Patel is on the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also with the Department of Homeland Security's Faith-Based Advisory Council. He holds a doctorate in sociology of religion from Oxford University. He studied as a Rhodes Scholar there. Grew up in, I believe, the Chicago area. Went to University of Illinois and then, of course, on to Oxford. He is coming to Utah for several events, including the main event, which is a convocations address at Utah State University in the Kent Concert Hall on Thursday, September 4th. It'll start at 7 p.m. It's free and open to the public. It's entitled Building Bridges of Interfaith Cooperation. And there will be a book signing of his latest book, Sacred Ground. That's immediately after the convocation. Books are available at the USU bookstore, also for sale that night at the venue, the convocation. And this convocation is a kicking off event for the Better Together campaign at USU. It's being organized by the new USU Interfaith Initiative. And if you'd like to get involved with them, you can email them at interfaith@usu.edu. They're also on Facebook and Twitter. Look for USU Interfaith Initiative. Eboo Patel, as I referenced before the break, some people, and this is usually influenced by whether or not you are a person of faith or not, some say the answer to this intolerance and violence is to de-emphasize faith. They say faith and religion itself is the problem.
Sure. So, I mean, I don't think that that's A, practical, which is to say I don't think it's going to happen, and B, I don't think it ought to happen. My religion plays a very important role in my life. It is the ethos that inspires the range of my actions, and there's a lot of other people I know who are like that as well. So I don't think the entire world is going to convert to a single worldview, whether that is Catholic or Pentecostal or secular atheist or Muslim or LDS, frankly. That doesn't mean that we should stop preaching our gospels. Of course we should preach our gospels, especially if in the case of, say, the Catholic or Pentecostal or LDS or Muslim traditions, it's a big part of our faith. And we should recognize that in addition to preaching, we should have a way of relating to other people positively in a cooperative way as well. So an evangelical Christian friend of mine puts this beautifully. He says that within Christianity, the way he understands it, is both the Great Commission, which is to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ as he sees it, and the Great Cooperation, which is to cooperate with others on common projects with a focus on appreciation, friendship, relationship, and service, and not a focus on conversion. And my experience with LDS folks across the country and around the world has been that they do this very, very well. They're clear when they're preaching their gospel, and they're clear when they're cooperating in the spirit of friendship and serving the common good. And that's also something I have great admiration for.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit about your faith as it is viewed, especially in America, especially, you know, post 9/11. I think there's still a strain of skepticism about the entire faith. In terms of in some people's views it tends to breed radicals and the moderates aren't speaking out enough and there's fear there. I wonder how
right.
You respond to that.
Well, I mean it's enormously sad for me, especially as a father raising a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old, that I don't turn on the news in the car. I don't turn on the news on the television because I am teaching them what I think is in Islam that lifts up the primary values of mercy, positive relationship, pluralism, ethical living, and so much of what we hear about Islam is the exact opposite of that. It's destruction, it's violence, it's divisiveness. And the fact is that there is a small but extremely active and vocal segment of people who call themselves Muslims, you know, far less than 1% of the entire Muslim population. But when they are armed to the teeth the way that they are, when they're hyper-aggressive the way that they are, and when they have a strategy of videotaping their beheadings, it's not a surprise that a lot of people around the world see that as the definition of Islam. But it's a great, great sadness to me as a Muslim and a Muslim father. You know, interestingly, I think Muslims and Mormons have something in common here, which is that if you look at surveys of religious attitudes in the United States, Muslims and Mormons both come in at the bottom. That large swaths of our fellow Americans have negative views of our religions, and that is very clearly a result of negative media images, which is to say, the people who twist our religion and who are very good at getting on television wind up representing the religion to many people, when in fact, the religion preaches exactly the opposite of that twisted view. But more of us need to be better at representing that, which is one of the reasons I think interfaith cooperation is so important. We know, both from human experiences, but also from social science research, that what really changes somebody's impression about a group or a tradition is positive, meaningful interaction with people in that tradition. There's now reams and reams of social science research on this. And so interfaith cooperation is a way of accomplishing that. It's a way for all groups, but I think especially groups in which there where other people have negative attitudes, like Muslims and Mormons, it's a way for us to be in direct personal encounter with people from different backgrounds, and for them to get to see us and work with us and therefore have a better impression of our traditions and our communities.
We just have about 3 or 4 minutes left. I'd like to take you back to high school. I'm wondering, the young Eboo Patel sitting around that lunch table with that very diverse, that United Nations of friends you had. In one way, you're very lucky, I think. What would you have liked to have seen that conversation look like if you'd have known what you know now?
Yeah, Tom, that's a great question. So few people ask me that question. Boy, I feel like I should write a new afterword to Acts of Faith in answer to that question. But I guess. You know, as I write in Acts of Faith, religion would come up in kind of side door ways. Somebody would say, oh, I can't play basketball because I have to go to some church thing on Sunday, right? Well, I think the way I would have liked that conversation to go is somebody saying, well, tell me about that church thing. You know, what are you doing? And what does it mean to you? You know, tell me about the role that plays in your heart and in your consciousness. And so I don't think it's a great idea to force a religion conversation, especially on 15-year-olds, but religion has a way of coming up in quotidian ways, and I think that if we engage those ways positively and strategically, it can create a constructive conversation. And I think that one of the things I really wish we had talked about was the way that we were each inspired by our religions to serve others. Because, so much of what everybody was doing was they were participating in church service projects or Hindu temple service projects or LDS service projects. And that's the kind of thing that anybody around the table can relate to and admire. But none of us felt comfortable enough sharing it. And I think that that's a tragedy. And I really hope that lunch tables today, which are just as diverse, if not more diverse, as my lunch table was back in 1990 at Glenbard South High School in Glen Ellyn, Illinois. I hope that young people feel more comfortable having those conversations, and I think it's going to be the Allison Fifes of the world. You know, whether she goes off to become an international businesswoman, she's a Huntsman Scholar at Utah State, or whether she becomes the principal of a school, she's going to be the person creating the environment for young people to feel comfortable sharing positively and appreciatively about their different religious traditions.
Allison Fife is with the USU Interfaith Initiative. That's a new initiative at USU, and you're welcome to join that if you're, students mostly, but you can inquire about that by emailing the group interfaith@usu.edu. They're also on Facebook and Twitter. Look for USU Interfaith Initiative. There'll be a convocations address featuring Eboo Patel, who's my guest on the program today. He's the founder and president of Interfaith Youth Corps, and that address is on the USU campus. at Utah State University on Thursday, September 4th. It's called Building Bridges of Interfaith Cooperation. It's the Kent Concert Hall, 7 p.m. It's free and open to the public. There'll be a book signing of his latest book, Sacred Ground, immediately following. Books are available at the USU bookstore and also for sale at the venue the night of the convocation address. And that convocation is a kicking off event for the Better Together campaign, which is being organized by the USU Interfaith Initiative. Their next event is a student-led interfaith speed faithing panel. That's held at the Taggart Student Center Auditorium on the USU campus, 7 p.m. on Wednesday, September 17th. As I said, if you're interested in anything with USU Interfaith Initiative, email the group interfaith@usu.edu. And there are a few spots available at a roundtable, which is being led by Ibu Patel. That's on Friday, September 5th, 8 to 10 a.m., and it's called Catalyzing Interfaith Leadership Best Practices. You can email the group interfaith@usu.edu to see if there's still space available. Ibu Patel, thanks so much for being with us today. It's a pleasure.
It was terrific being with you. Thank you. I'm excited to be in Utah next week. I'll be both at Utah Valley University and at Utah State University, and it's been circled on my calendar for many months. It's something I'm very excited about.
Very good. Thank you so much, and we'll look forward to having you in Utah. And thanks for listening to Access Utah.
Utah writer Gina Wickwar.
Having just made two airplane round trips in just as many weeks and suffering all the various indignities this entails, I have a few comments to make. This is because the other morning, as I sat reading the paper, I caught a report on television about a real fracas on some national airline. A full-blown brawl, said the TV guy, one the flight attendants had to break up with the help of other passengers. Nothing about terrorism, nothing about being patted down by some snarky TSA person, nothing about x-raying your new knee or having to dump that brand new $5 bottle of water you just bought. No, nothing of the sort. The fisticuffs taking place at 32,000 feet were about, get this, legroom. Both my husband and I perked up at that because, as you know, leg space in an airplane steerage section has always been as rare as hen's teeth. Its lack has long been decried by all the poor souls who are stuffed into coach class and who, unless they are under 5'3", sit with their knees elevated to somewhere near their sternums. So what was this brouhaha about airplane leg space that could possibly be new? Well, it seems there is this novel device, perfectly legal, at least at the moment, called a knee defender. Its two pieces hook on either side of your deployed meal tray and totally prevent the person in front of you from doing what we all do, press the armrest button to lean back in our seats. The knee defender brings an abrupt halt to that maneuver. As a result, the knee defender was the culprit behind that little contretemps in the stratosphere. After thinking about it for about 3 seconds, I decided I'm on the side of the knee defender. I know tons of people like to use their laptops when they fly, and it's impossible to do so when the person in front of you has her seat back down. It's also hard to eat your 1 centimeter square bag of peanuts and drink your 1 ounce Diet Coke while your tray has been pushed into your gut. I, for one, will gladly bear sitting upright for 4 hours because I know how I feel when the person in front of me kicks back and destroys my day. On the other hand, I can sort of see the other side. If you really want to lean back and can't, you might get a tad testy. But start a fight about it? Frankly, I'd rather go to the barricades for an extra 2 bag of pretzels and a full can of Sprite. This is Gina Wickwar.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Temperature is 56 degrees on University Hill. The time now is 10 o'clock.